Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters to talk about coverage of the week's news. The recent explosion at the Soma coal mine in Turkey left 301 people dead. They died from carbon monoxide inhalation. This made international news for the first few days, but the biggest coal mine disaster in Turkey's history has since disappeared from the front pages. Coal counts for 30% of Turkey's energy needs. Five company officials, including the mine's operating manager, have been arrested on charges of causing death by negligence. Joining us to discuss coverage is Alexander Christy Miller, a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. Alexander writes for a number of publications, including the Times of London and the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Alexander. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, hi, great to be here.
Hi, it's great to have you. And here in the U.S., fracking continues to make headlines. A new poll by the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council found that 68% of Californians support a bill pending in Sacramento that would halt fracking until the state has a chance to study its safety. And on Tuesday, the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors unanimously approved a permanent ban on fracking. It's the first county in California to ban fracking. And there's a new report out by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It found that oil companies are expected to extract only 600 million barrels of oil from the Monterey Shale, as opposed to the almost 14 billion barrels promised by oil companies. Joining us to talk about media coverage of all of this is David Baker. He's a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, where he focuses on energy and clean technology. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back. And we're joined by Lisa Song, an investigative journalist with Inside Climate News. She's one of the lead reporters of their eight-month investigation, Fracking the Eagle Ford Shale, Big Oil and Bad Air on the Texas Prairie. The Center for Public Integrity and the Weather Channel were also involved in this investigation. And one of Lisa's pieces focuses on a South Texas couple living in a heavily fracked county. They say that health issues are forcing them to look for a new home. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, David, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Actually, I'm going to do a bit of a throwback here. The thing that I read this week that most impressed me was actually a story that came out in February in The New Yorker that I just sort of been in my must-read pile, and I hadn't gotten to it until now, but it's a very, very good one. It's by George Packer, looking at what's happened between Amazon and the book publishing industry over the last decade or so. And it's a very long piece. It's not a quick read, but it's one of these things that will give you a window into multiple industries at the same time and really lays out sort of how online commerce and the book publishing industry have changed over the last decade. Is definitely worth going back on their website and taking a look at it. It's definitely the best thing that I've read this week.
Oh, interesting. So what was the one piece that really stood out for you?
Well, it sort of traces how Amazon, which, you know, most of us think of as a place to go buy DVDs or various things like that, it traces how it started out as, you know, essentially just an online marketplace, the way many people still think of it, but had very deep ties from the beginning into the book world, and also how Amazon, even though we still think of it as a purveyor of commodities like books and CDs and DVDs, it's also essentially a giant mechanism for gathering data on us, on the kinds of things that we want to buy. And it's, as I say, an absolutely fascinating glimpse into, you know, not just some companies, but whole industries that have been changing a lot in the last decade.
And David, I'm glad you brought this up. Have you been following this controversy over the fact that the Washington Post is not covering Amazon's decision to try to discourage customers from buying Hatchet books by delaying their deliveries?
I haven't been looking at the Washington Post on this,
well,
but I mean, yeah.
It's interesting because Jeff Bezos now owns the Washington Post, and a lot
exactly.
of critics are saying, okay, wait a minute, I thought you weren't going to have your hand in the editorial process, and the Washington Post has not been covering this yet.
Yeah, there is no bigger test for a news organization than to report on its own owners, and sadly, most news organizations don't do a very good job of it.
Yep.
It's not a new phenomenon,
unfortunately. Well, yeah, we'll definitely have to follow this because it's really interesting if that's the case so soon. I mean, it's just been months since he bought it.
Yeah, and everybody's still sort of waiting to see, you know, if there is a different vision in the place. I mean, just beyond the question of whether or not they're willing to report on the guy's core business, whether or not he brings in a different sensibility or lays out a different mission for them and how they're supposed to, you know, migrate online, we're still all waiting to get a sense of that. Mm.
All right, so kudos to George Packard at The New Yorker, and we'll put a link to that piece right after our show. Thank you. That's David Baker with the San Francisco Chronicle. And what about you, Lisa? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there was a great article in Newsweek about a small town in Utah that saw a sudden increase in infant deaths last year. And there's some suspicion that it's caused by local air pollution because the town is in the middle of a huge oil and gas boom, and all of that pollution contributes to their problems with ozone. And the story, it's not a long piece, but it does a really good job of explaining how hard it is to get concrete answers in these types of situations. And you run into this all the time, whether it's fracking or a refinery or any kind of industrial pollution. You have, you know, you'll have local residents who are sick and they believe their illnesses are caused by that pollution. But when it comes time to get the data and the studies, it's always just really hard because it's difficult and expensive.
And we'll talk with you about how hard it was for you to get data in your reporting in Texas. But in terms of what's happening in Utah, where did the Newsweek reporter turn to get this information?
Well, she got her information. The main person she interviewed was a local midwife who has worked there for 19 years and recently noticed this sudden increase in infant mortality and is trying to get answers. I believe the state of Utah is now starting a study to try and see if they can find anything from the data. But for some reason, they're not using the data from 2013, which is when the increase in deaths became evident. So I'm not sure why that is, and that, of course, would affect the results.
Wow. Well, we'll link to that Newsweek piece right after the show. Thanks for that. And what about you, Alexander? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I think that the best piece I've seen yet written on the Soma mining disaster was a piece by Noah Blazer in the International Business Times. And what he did was he spoke to a lot of miners and safety officials who were actually working in the mine, and just created a very, you know, he showed very convincingly how there had been a real escalation in safety concerns there in the weeks leading up to the disaster that were sort of focused around overproduction or a big emphasis on production at the expense of safety. The other thing that he did very well, and which hasn't really been looked at enough yet, are the some of the links between this company and the government, which is obviously very important at the moment. Now that you know, after these arrests in this case last week, it seems that the government is trying to distance itself from this company.
Well,
and he did it really with some very compelling human stories as well. I mean, there was one woman he interviewed who was the widow of a miner who died in the tragedy, and she was saying how her husband had been telling her that he was concerned about rising heat in the mine and how he was concerned about the danger there, and then, you know, obviously one day he didn't come home.
Well, the piece that you wrote in the Christian Science Monitor is called "Miners Say Safety Declined After Turkey Privatized Soma Mine." 301 people have died. This received international headlines in the days after it happened, but it's starting to disappear. First off, can you just give us a little bit of background? What led to this explosion? I mean, are you comfortable, you know, putting this into your piece to really point to one example or a few examples?
Well, in terms of the specific conditions in the mine, I spoke to a guy who was working as a safety official there, who told me that there was one particular area of the mine which had very high methane levels, And this guy's job, he was one of several people whose job it was to measure methane levels and seal off areas when the methane was judged to be too high. He said to me that there were small fires breaking out in the mine almost on a daily basis, and that the methane leaks were so frequent that it was hard to plug them in time. And in this particular area, this area had been sealed off about 3 months ago, but the company had unsealed it about on May the 1st when they decided that the methane levels would probably have lowered. They wanted to mine there, and this was the area that he believed the fire broke out in. This is obviously. This tallies in general terms with what we're hearing from investigators. The consensus generally now seems to be falling on the hypothesis that this was caused by high methane levels, essentially.
And more than 1,000 miners have died between 2002 and 2012. So this isn't new.
No. I mean, Turkey has a long and very poor history of mine safety. I mean, it's one of the few countries in the world not to have ratified the International Labour Organization's Convention 178 on mining safety. But what you've seen change really in the last 5 or 6 years is that the current Turkish government has put a massive emphasis on lignite and coal mining. As a way of providing domestic fuel to poor people, and also on generating electricity for Turkey's domestic market. Turkey has very little in the way of oil and gas. It has virtually none. So it's a big net energy importer, and it's trying to change that and so it's really turned to coal in a big way in the last few years. And as part of that, it privatized the coal industry. And this has led to far more intensive mining, and so you've seen just in the last 5 or 6 years as well a rise in the number of deaths of miners, because it seems that this increase in the intensity of mining hasn't been accompanied by investment in great safety.
You and other journalists have reported on the privatization and the lax safety standards. What angles are the media in Turkey taking in covering this disaster?
Well, the Turkish media is phenomenally, like the country itself, the Turkish media is phenomenally polarized. The anti-government media has obviously been very critical of the government's handling of the disaster, obviously internationally as well. This has been a big thing. The Prime Minister made several extraordinary kind of PR blunders on the day after it. He appeared to sort of physically manhandle a grieving demonstrator. One of his aides kicked another demonstrator, and so they've been focused on this. As time has gone on, there's been more focus on the potential links between this company and the government as well. And then from the pro-government press, there's been a big focus on the foreign media and sort of alleging that the foreign media is using this event as an excuse to attack Turkey, which is it's kind of a common theme in Turkey's pro-government media. I mean, it's really now, though. I mean, there's been more stuff just happening in the last couple of days. There was a man was killed by police in Istanbul yesterday, and it seems that, sadly, the very important issues that need to be discussed as a result of the Soma mining disaster are now being overtaken by another tragedy. So it's quite a depressing time in some ways.
That is Alexander Christie Miller. He's a freelance journalist based in Istanbul who has been covering the recent explosion at the Soma coal mine in Turkey, which has left 301 people dead so far. The death toll is expected to rise. We're also joined by Lisa Song, an investigative journalist with Inside Climate News, and David Baker, a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, focusing on energy and clean technology. David, how do coal standards compare with other sources of energy when you look at specifically regulation?
You're talking in the United States?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an international body that looks at this. There's international regulation, but do you know anything about the international laws?
For coal, no, I don't. In the United States, we do have quite a few regulations that apply, and we also have a long history of companies essentially ignoring those regulations. And that has led to some of the disasters that we've had with coal mines. They just haven't been, you know, quite as huge as this one. I'm very interested to hear, though, from Alexander. I mean, you talk about the coal production there rising at a pretty rapid clip over the last few years, with accidents occurring at more and more frequently. Obviously, with 301 people dead, this is going to be a huge issue in any country where this might happen. But has there been any kind of public outcry before this, with all the problems that have been popping up in their coal mines?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, there was really. I mean, there was an incident in 2010 when 30 miners were killed, and that obviously not nearly on the same scale, but that caused some outcry. I mean, just 20 days before the latest disaster, the main opposition party in Turkey filed a motion in Parliament to launch a parliamentary inquiry into the mines in that region, including the Soma mine. That was turned down by the government. The sad thing is this.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I was to say the sad thing is this kind of was on people's radar, but it wasn't obviously enough on people's radar.
So the question is, I mean, did anything actually in the end come of it in terms of like different regulations or better enforcement of their regulations?
As far as I'm aware, the government has brought in, it did bring in, I think in 2012, it brought in new mining regulations. But the problem is, the problem is that in Turkey, the mining is controlled, or the regulation of mining falls between two different ministries, the Ministry of Energy and the Ministry of Labor. The Ministry of Energy is responsible for the mines, and the Ministry of Labor is responsible for the safety of the workers. So it seems that regulation has basically fallen between two stools, and no one has been taking, proper responsibility for it. I've been trying to delve into this question of who should have been regulating what, in the last few days, and the fact is it's a phenomenally complicated one, probably more complicated than it should be, probably. Mm-hmm.
And Alexander, a lot of personal stories have been told about this disaster. How has that changed the narrative?
That's one of the things which is I guess gives you cause for sort of hope here the country is really, if the country is divided on everything else, it's united in sympathy for these miners and in sympathy for the difficult conditions under which they've been working and the lack of safety. I think there's overwhelming public support for some kind of reform as a result of the stories that we've seen emerging of what happened to these guys and now the situation that their families are in.
And Lisa, before we let Alexander go, I mean, you focus on these issues here in the States. Do you have any questions for him?
I guess I'm curious to know, here in the U.S., we talk about how coal is declining and we're replacing a lot of our coal-fired electricity with natural gas. Is there a similar trend of doing that in Turkey, or is Turkey still very dependent on coal?
Well, Turkey has actually become more dependent on coal in recent years. It's actually in 2012, its plans for new coal-based electricity generation were the fourth biggest in the world after Russia, China, and India. So Turkey's kind of a bit of an outlier in that it's heading for coal big time. The reason really is that Turkey has no natural gas or oil of its own, and it runs a very large current account deficit, which is largely as a result of importing gas and oil production and demand. So we itself are actually back to the rating gas.
You know, Alexander, I think we're losing you, but we were going to say goodbye in a minute. So thank you so much for joining us. I think we lost
him. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you, Alexander. That is Alexander Christie Miller. He's a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. He's been covering the recent explosion at the Soma coal mine in Turkey, which has left 301 people dead. They died from carbon monoxide inhalation. This made international news for the first few days after it happened, but it's slowly starting to disappear. So we wanted to talk to Alexander about what's going on behind the scenes and how this is being covered. And you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is David Baker, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, focusing on energy and clean technology. He's got a piece out about new Monterey shale oil estimates rocking California's expectations. We're also joined by Lisa Song, an investigative journalist with Inside Climate News, and one of the lead reporters of the 8-month investigation, Fracking the Eagle Ford Shale, Big Oil and Bad Air on the Texas Prairie. The Center for Public Integrity and the Weather Channel were also involved. And Lisa, just hearing Alexander talk about regulation and the difficulties in reporting on something like a mining disaster. I mean, we've had these in the U.S. But what about that resonated with you, especially when you report on something like air pollution?
It was incredibly challenging. Our main challenge in reporting this series was that the Texas regulatory agencies in charge of both air pollution and oil and gas drilling made it really difficult for us to get any information. We tried multiple times to talk to their experts on the phone, but every time their media office, you know, would not allow us to talk to any of their scientists on the phone. Even their media representatives wouldn't talk to us on the phone. We had to put all of our questions in writing. And for something as complicated as energy regulations and science and epidemiology, that's really not an ideal way to get your information. So we really had to go outside of the agency in many cases and talk to former retired officials or scientists and engineers working in the general field of air pollution, even if they didn't work for these particular regulators.
David, can you talk about your experience in talking with regulators here in California? Do you have similar experiences?
You know, I haven't done the kind of really deep dive into a specific question that these folks were doing here. But in general, I've had a better experience with regulators here in California. And I do think, from talking with other reporters around the country, that California government is a bit more open than most. That isn't always the case, and it can change a lot depending on, you know, who's sitting in the governor's office and who the appointees are at the top of various agencies. Also, frankly, some agencies seem to be more on the ball than others and actually have better data than others do. But, you know, there have been occasions when various agencies have tried to stonewall me, but I do think it's better here than it is in other states. I haven't had that kind of, like, just complete go-away experience that she's describing there.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That's David Baker, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Lisa Song is an investigative journalist with Inside Climate News. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Lisa's piece looking at a South Texas couple living in a heavily fracked county. They are looking for a new home after 23 years. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with award-winning journalist and author Miriam Powell about her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. What do we need to know about one of the most significant Latino leaders in U.S. history? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news, and we are talking about media coverage of fracking. There's a lot of activity happening on this front in California. A new poll by the Sierra Club and the National Resources Defense Council found that 68% of Californians support a bill pending in Sacramento that would halt fracking until the state has a chance to study its safety. And on Tuesday, the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors unanimously approved a permanent ban on fracking. It's the first county in the state to ban fracking. And then we will talk with David, staff writer with The Chronicle, about a new report by the U.S. Energy Information Administration that found oil companies are expected to extract only 600 million barrels of oil from the Monterey Shale, as opposed to the almost 14 billion barrels promised by oil companies. So we'll find out why there's such a massive discrepancy there. We're also joined by Lisa Song, investigative journalist with Inside Climate News and one of the lead reporters of an 8-month investigation fracking the Eagle Ford Shale, big oil and bad air on the Texas prairie. And Lisa, you conducted this investigation with the Center for Public Integrity and the Weather Channel. And one of your pieces focuses on a South Texas couple living in a heavily fracked county, and they say that health issues have forced them to look for a new home. They've lived there for 23 years. You know, what's so interesting about fracking is whenever we do these shows, you know, there's scientists on, quote, both sides, right, saying that, yes, there are health problems. No, it hasn't been scientifically proven yet. And it's interesting when you look at pieces, reporters tend to start with the human side of this because it's hard to tell someone, oh, no, your asthma is not bad, or no, you don't have a hard time breathing. So can you talk about this? What happens when you find a couple or, you know, families, people who claim that they have health issues because of fracking? How do you prove that?
I don't think there, it's very rare that you have the data to be able to prove a real cause and effect. That's just not, that kind of data normally doesn't exist. For this family, for example, they live in Karnes County, which is really the epicenter of where the drilling is occurring in South Texas, and yet there are no air monitors anywhere in the county. The state of Texas had placed 5 air monitors in the general Eagle Ford region, but they're all at the very edges of the shale play, so they don't, none of them are where the drilling is highest. And the really difficult thing about these health stories is that every person, depending on their immune system and their DNA, reacts differently to the pollutants. So you can have 2 people living in the same house exposed to the same level of pollution, and one person may get sick and the other one may not get sick. And even when you look at the person who is sick, it would take a lot of work to try and link their symptoms to the activity that's occurring around them. And so in the Eagle Ford, what we found is no one has really gone in and tried to do an epidemiology study on what is happening to the population at large. Instead, what you have are hundreds of complaints from residents over the past few years, all saying, you know, something is happening with my water or the air, or I'm concerned about some fracking-related waste that's being dumped nearby. And what needs to happen is if you want concrete answers, then you need scientists to go in and start doing surveys and studies.
So in the case of the couple you spoke with, Lynn Burring, 58, says that her asthma has worsened. She has chest pains, dizziness, constant fatigue, extreme sensitivity to smells. And other neighbors are also saying the same thing?
Well, with her situation and what others are saying, the types of symptoms they are reporting, these respiratory illnesses, strange body rashes, trouble with balance, tremors, these are all the types of symptoms that can be caused by the types of chemicals we know are being emitted from these facilities. That is sort of the most concrete answer you have until you can do an actual study. And the difficult thing is we know certain toxic chemicals are being released in large quantities in some cases from these wells and compressor stations and processing plants, but we really don't know how much of the pollutants are actually going towards someone's house, because depending on the wind direction and the weather, those pollutants could go up in the air and disperse, or they could blow straight towards someone's house or blow in the opposite direction. And you need a lot of data to figure that out. Hmm. And data is what we don't have.
Right, because you report that the 8-month investigation revealed that despite hundreds of complaints, Texas regulators know little about air quality in the 26-county Eagle Ford region, which has 9,000 wells and another 5,500 permitted. How many people live in this area? That's a lot of wells.
Well, there's only about 1 million people in this 26-county area, and that's another problem. Is rural areas often get less attention in terms of whether it's media attention or research money. It's easier for example, we found that in North Texas, where you have the Barnett Shale boom that began years ago, they managed to get some stricter air regulations there. The local residents were able to organize and demand some additional protections, and now there are more protections there that don't apply in the Eagle Ford Shale.
Tell us a little bit about the corporation that's involved in all of this. The facilities are owned by Marathon Oil. That's a Houston-based company worth nearly $25 billion as of 2013. Alexander Christie Miller was talking earlier about the close relationship between the coal companies and the government. What is the relationship between Marathon Oil and the Texas government?
Well, I can't speak to Marathon in particular, but from our investigation, we found that I think everyone knows Texas is a very business-friendly state, and one of the figures we got was nearly 1 in 4 Texas state legislators or their spouses have some kind of connection or benefit to companies that operate in the Eagle Ford, whether it's getting some money from a stock or other kind of royalties. So that shows the extent of the connection between this industry and the Texas government. And, of course, their governor as well, Governor Rick Perry, he does not believe in anthropogenic climate change, and he is the one who appoints the three commissioners in the state's environmental regulatory agency.
That is Lisa Song, an investigative journalist with Inside Climate News, and you can read her investigation at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by David Baker, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, focusing on energy and clean technology. So, David, in this particular area in Texas, regulators know little about air quality, and we've done a lot of shows about how we don't know much about fracking chemicals in California, but there's a huge push to try to release the information. What is the status of that, and how do you as a reporter do your work when there's so many unanswered questions?
It's in terms of the status, I mean, the real work is still to come. I mean, the big law that was passed here last year, SB4, that placed new regulations on fracking, that triggered a study of essentially all of the big questions that surround fracking in the U.S., impact on water quality, impact on air quality, possible impact on human health, possible impact on seismicity even, whether or not it can lead to more earthquakes. But that study is just getting underway. I'm happy about that element of the law as a reporter, because it means there's going to be much more data generated that we can delve into, and it's going to be, you know, collected specifically for this purpose, for looking at fracking. But we still have to wait for that. And in the meantime, we're sort of left with not a whole heck of a lot. In terms of, like, fracking chemicals, we can trace basically what's being used by looking at this voluntary website, Frack Focus, which companies that frack nationwide post information to. You can look at that, see where they're operating, even down to the level of different streets and roads in rural areas. And you can see, in general, the chemicals that they're using. Again, that's voluntary, and it's the kind of thing where you're looking at it, but you don't really get much context. You have to sort of try to guess at where some of this information might be useful. the state study that's getting underway is going to be a lot more accessible to everyone, including reporters, but we're going to have to wait for it.
That's David Baker with the San Francisco Chronicle. Lisa Song is with Inside Climate News. And if you have questions for David and Lisa about how they go about reporting the issue of fracking and air quality when we don't have that much information from state officials, we'd love to hear from you. And then what are your thoughts overall about fracking reporting, specifically the environmental and health impacts? If you live in Santa Cruz in the area, your Board of Supervisors recently voted to ban fracking. How was it covered in the area? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, David, this happened in Santa Cruz, and we're going to be seeing other efforts in other counties. I understand that there are probably going to be some fracking measures also on the ballot in November. What else are you hearing from around the state?
Well, a lot of the action is going to be taking place at the local level, just like the Santa Cruz ordinance that was just passed. I mean, Butte County is also looking at this. You've got efforts underway down in Los Angeles as well, which actually does have still active oil fields right in the midst of all that metropolitan growth. So you're seeing a lot of action there at the local level, and there is new action, new momentum for a statewide moratorium, which is an idea that's been floated the last couple of years and just keeps getting shot down. There is a bill that's being studied in the Senate Appropriations Committee, and they're due to make a decision on it probably either today or at the start of next week on whether or not they're going to let that go to the full Senate floor for a vote. It has to go to the full Senate floor for a vote by May 30th, or it dies under California's legislative rules. And that bill would essentially put all fracking on hold in the state while the state conducts that big study that I was just talking about. A similar idea was floated around last year, couldn't get traction, but this year it seems to be getting more support than it did last time around. Governor Brown is not in favor of that. He's been fairly supportive of fracking up till now and wants it to continue while the state studies its effects. But it might be the case that the legislature is willing to go that direction, much more so than they were before.
Well, let's hear from a listener on this. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that, you hear these stories about so many illnesses and so many people getting sick, and the response is always requests for more data. And, I really wonder, people show up at the emergency room and they're sick with something, does it really require that we all go home and wait for more data? Both sides seem to be relying on this. People are sick, faucets of water are lighting on fire. I don't know what more evidence would be required.
Well, thank you. I mean, Lisa, in the case of your report and the people that you interviewed, how did Texas politicians respond to this?
Well, the response we got from the regulators was, our air monitoring results show that the air overall is healthy. But they're saying that despite the fact that they don't really have monitors in the Eagle Ford Shale. So in this case, the lack of data becomes something they can use to say nothing is wrong. And this is incredibly frustrating to the people who live there and who just want answers. And I think you run into this problem with every kind of pollution story that's out there.
So what are you hearing from the people in Texas? The woman you interviewed, Lynn Burring, says, quote, "We're not anti-drilling. My complaint is they need to do it in a responsible way. It's just causing me a lot of medical issues, and I can't have it." And again, she and her husband are now looking for a new home after 23 years of living on the South Texas prairie. What did you hear from other people in the area?
Other people have similar concerns. We interviewed some families who are, for example, primarily concerned about things like noise pollution. It's incredibly noisy if you're living in a home next to wells that are being drilled during that phase. Others are more worried about water pollution. And there are families, though, that because they have leased some of their land to the industry, that are getting a lot of money in royalties for that. One of the families we interviewed, for the first time, they have financial security, and it's because they have leased their mineral rights to the industry. But at the same time, this family said that they do worry about whether the pollution is having an impact on themselves and their grandkids. They actually live from a processing plant that's just 200 yards from their backyard, and there are flares there and all sorts of emission sources.
We just got an email from Alan, David. He says, if we studied fracking as much as we study Benghazi, then we can call a Republican with our findings.
I don't even know where to go with that. No, I mean, put it this way. I'm very happy that we are studying fracking to the extent that we have, because there are so many outstanding questions. And yet, you know, the caller David's question or comment about how frustrating it is to always say we need more information. Well, yeah, it is incredibly frustrating, you know. And any kind of issue where you think people are getting sick from some kind of environmental pollutant is inherently going to end up in this same situation. I've seen it with different cases, completely unrelated to fracking, where, you know, someone gets sick, they think it is possibly due to this problem with their air or their water, and they may be right, but it is very difficult to nail that down, even for one person, much less a group of people. So yeah, I totally get the frustration out there. I feel it to a certain extent myself.
Well, thank you for the email, and thank you for calling, David. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's also, you know, just it's so important to follow what's happening at the state and local levels. In North Carolina, on Thursday, they became the latest state to approve a bill that, if ratified by the House and the governor, would lift a moratorium on fracking. While the amount of extractable gas known to be in North Carolina is much smaller than in many other states where fracking's legal, North Carolina politicians have completely embraced fracking, and they've ignited a firestorm of controversy. So, David, I mean, there's just so many things happening, you know, across the country at the state and local levels.
Yeah, and that's because the federal government is essentially allowing that to be this way. And you will pretty much never hear President Obama say the word fracking.
Right.
I have yet to find it in any of his quotes. He doesn't even like saying hydraulic fracturing, the more proper term for it. Instead, he will talk about how great this boom in domestic gas or domestic oil is. And pretty much every time you hear him say domestic gas, it's sort of code for fracking. But the federal government essentially has decided, okay, we're going to set standards for what happens on federal lands, and beyond that, you know, it's going to be state by state. And that has historically been the way oil has been regulated in this country. So here in California, you know, we've got this vast shale formation that people have been trying to tap. The state's taking the lead on what happens in terms of regulation there. And so far, we've had some regulation, but, you know, not terribly much, at least in terms of things that just affect fracking.
Let's talk about the piece you recently reported on. It's getting a lot of attention. The U.S. Energy Information Administration came out with a new report that found oil companies are expected to extract only 600 million barrels of oil from the Monterey Shale, as opposed to the 14 billion barrels promised by oil companies. So 600 million versus 13 billion barrels. First, can you give us a little bit of background on this?
Actually, for a long time, most people believed it was going to be more than 15 billion. That was the most commonly touted figure, and that came from the same federal agency. It's the statistics branch of the Department of Energy. And then a couple years ago, the Energy Information Administration very quietly lowered its estimate down to 13.7 billion, and then this past a couple of days ago, they slashed it. I think it's coming. It's in a report that's due to come out in the next couple of weeks. And they did it not because they don't think the oil is there. They're quite convinced there's oil down there. It's simply a matter of whether or not you can get at that oil and produce it with today's technologies. And in spite of using fracking to get at it, and in spite of using acidizing, where you pump acids down the well to dissolve rocks, this particular shale formation has proved to be very, very stubborn. And so this is essentially the federal government's statistics people saying, okay, we just don't think this is going to be produced in large quantities anytime soon. That doesn't mean that somebody won't figure out some way to do it, because if there's the possibility of a lot of oil to be had, somebody is going to keep working at it. But for the moment, it looks like this boom that the oil companies have said we might be getting may not materialize after all.
Well, I mean, this is huge news because this cuts the forecast by 96%. Mm-hmm. Where did the 13.7 billion barrel number come from in the first place?
The EIA sort of farmed out some of, well, they do this with a lot of things. They farmed out studies to various consultants who look at the exploration that's been done in various formations, try to put together an estimate of what people might get. And so essentially what you're seeing here is just different iterations of that over the last few years, with them constantly ratcheting it back down in terms of what they think is going to happen. The reason it's such a dramatic drop-off is that there's a lot more data now that the government can look at in terms of companies going out there, drilling wells, trying different techniques, and then seeing what comes back up, how much oil they get out of it. So, you know, there's still a lot of exploration activity going on in the shale formation, and the number will probably be refined further and further in the coming years. But now that we've actually had a chance to see whether or not companies are successful in tapping this stuff, that's the reason why the government is rationing it back. Mm. They're essentially saying, okay, we're not seeing the production numbers that you would expect, therefore we think this stuff is not going to be as producible as we had expected.
Lisa, how should reporters deal with numbers like this? Because you often hear about, you know, what is the potential for these wells? How many jobs will Keystone create, for example? I mean, 13.7 billion barrels down to 600 million is just massive. How do you deal with that when you get these kinds of government estimates?
I think one way I might look at it is compare the new estimate with what is expected to come out of the Marcellus Shale, for example, and put it in context. You know, is it significantly less than what we expect from the Bakken or the Marcellus or the Eagle Ford? And if so, is that going to decrease the interest from oil companies in trying to drill into the shale? Or does it just make them more determined to try new techniques to get more oil out of it?
Because these numbers greatly shape public opinion, right?
Well, they do. David? They do help shape public opinion. I mean, they're not, and they could affect the industry's attitude overall. But I mean, you know, if you're a company that's out there exploring the shale formation, you're going to care first and foremost about what your own data tell you, as opposed to what the federal government puts out. So if you're looking at specific wells that you're working with and you think they've got potential, you think various techniques have potential, you're still going to keep doing it. That said, I mean, there's been a lot of interest in the Monterey Shale from the oil industry, and yet a number of companies have become kind of frustrated with the formation themselves. Chevron, the biggest oil company left here in California, they've been producing from the wells in the Central Valley for over a century at this point, and they've been very skeptical in public about the Monterey Shale over the last couple of years, saying they just don't see the kinds of big booming numbers that you would see in North Dakota and Texas, and therefore it's just not as interesting to them. So there have already been a fair number of contrarian voices in the industry saying this is not panning out the way we thought. There will still be people, however, who will keep trying to do it to try to crack that nut, because, as I said, it's not that the oil isn't there. It's just a question of figuring out how to get at it and do so in a way that you can reproduce over and over.
Hmm. And David, we have just about a minute or so left. What are you working on right now?
Oh, good Lord, a number of completely unrelated things, it would seem. I'm taking a look, something I'm going to be doing for next week, taking a look at the state's drive for getting more fuel cell vehicles on the road, which is kind of an odd idea in some ways, in that a lot of people consider fuel cells to be quite unworkable for a mass technology for cars, and yet California and some of the car companies are still very, very interested in it. And so that's one of the things I'm doing at the moment.
All right. And Lisa, what are you working on right now?
I'm becoming very interested in the idea of the public health response to people who think they're getting sick from fracking. And there are a number of health experts who are trying to help doctors deal with this and perhaps address the problem better.
Is that countrywide? I know in Los Angeles there are a number of doctors. There's actually a specific group of doctors focusing specifically on fracking.
Yeah, there aren't too many of them around the country, though, because it's not something a lot of doctors are trained to do in medical school. So it's interesting to see how they're trying to get professional training.
Lisa Song is an investigative journalist with Inside Climate News. You can find her 8-month investigation, Fracking the Eagle Ford Shale, Big Oil, and Bad Air on the Texas Prairie, at our website, yourcallradio.org. David Baker is a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, focusing on energy and clean technology, and you can also find his latest pieces there. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation with award-winning journalist and author Miriam Powell about her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. Chavez went from being a migrant worker to leader of one of the most influential movements in the 20th century, inspiring generations of activists and community organizers. So what do we need to know about one of the most significant Latino leaders in U.S. history? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.